So, hello everybody. Yes, I'm interested to try to understand a bit better what the sun can do to the Earth climate. I think there are many persons. I'm going to take two approaches in this talk. First, I'm going to show you some of the results in my group we have been doing on solar magnetism and with Yuri's group. And another thing is going to be on what is the current understanding of the sun's influence on the Earth climate. So the fact I wanted to recall everybody, the northern hemisphere mean temperature has risen by about 0.8 Kelvin over the last 110 years, 0.6 Kelvin during the last 50 years, and just to put that in perspective, between the 17th century and 1900, only 0.1 K. So a lot of people are saying the mean temperature is rising over the last 100 years when the human have been starting to create their own greenhouse gas and most importantly CO2. So the most heard story is that the sun contributes to a maximum of 0.1 K during the pre-industrial era and to about 0.17 K during this last century. So let's say at maximum the sun has about a contribution of 20% plus or minus some error bar, and almost a lot of people say almost none in the last 50 years. There is a less heard story, which is that actually the sun contributes to perhaps 0.35 K during the pre-industrial era up to 0.4 K in the last century, which will be a contribution of 50%. So here we are starting to be clearly a different scenario than what we heard in the previous one, that the sun has a minimal role, and that it could be up to 15K, 0.15K over the last 0.6K of this last 50 years. So that it will contribute a significant amount. So we have to understand, is that true or not? We have to see what is the contribution of the sun. Is it important or is it negligible?
Without the sun, we have nothing. So you're talking here about the 11-year cycle or something?
You will see. Yeah, I'm speaking of many things. Of course, the 11-year cycle. No, but you will see. No, but that's the, of course, the variation of the sun, of the solar, yes, total solar irradiance, but not only. Perhaps it's more subtle than just the total solar irradiance, as you will see. So, of course, everybody knows that the sun has a butterfly diagram of sunspot emergence that lasts about 11 years. The total cycle of the sun is 22 years. We have these 9 sunspots. I just like to recall that this is a 60,000 by 60,000 kilometer wide picture. So this granule is about the size of Texas or France. And you can see that depends from which country you come. And this is clearly a big active region. And just to show you some evidence of emergence, popularity, and also we believe the sun is running what we will call a small scale versus large scale dynamo. Here you have this kind of salt and paper background, which will be a magnetic field created on the scale of the turbulent flow. And you have large scale structures, which are linked to a large scale dynamo and emergence. So, current understanding of how the sun works is that, okay, you have a radiative interior, which is about 70% of the interior of the sun. Then the sun is convective, highly convective, turbulent Reynolds numbers of 10 to the 15. You certainly create a lot of field in that convection zone. You pump it down or transport it through large-scale meridional flow. You have a strong shear at the base of the convection zone called the tachocline, and you organize certainly this magnetic field. And you can get a cycle and hope to close the loop, and some of this field will eventually emerge as active region or be recycled. And we can ask ourselves, is there an interaction with a fossil field inside the sun with the dynamo-generated field? So there are interesting theoretical issues on the sun and understanding. So the basic scenario, the basic process is to wind up magnetic field lines into the omega effect, and you have either cyclonic turbulence or different processes linked related to the decay of this structure at the surface called the Bacot-Layton effect. That will lead to the magnetism and close the dynamo loop. Because what's important to understand in dynamo is that you have to close the dynamo loop. It's not just a question of generating toroidal field. You need to be able to regenerate the other component of the magnetic field. And that requires another process. Most of the time we call it the alpha effect. So here are recent simulations we have been doing with Yuri and my colleagues, Mark Misch and others. So here on the left, you have very high resolution simulation of the sun. So we go to 1500 cube, about that, in terms of spherical harmonics for the climate, Lmax of 680. We are starting to make models that go to 1300. So we're starting to do serious simulation here. And you can see it's small scale, of course, not granulation, but small scale. A lot of temperature variation also and modulation. Of course, this is convection, so heat is transported outward and cold correlate well with downflows and hot with upflows. And you put magnetic field, and you see that magnetic field is happy in the convection zone. You get... barely. Perhaps the smallest one are at the supergranulation scale, you see. But the other one, not. It's very difficult to map the sphere down to the granular scale. But yes, we have a nice range which encompass, go past the Rossby radius, and so it's quite nice. We have scales that feel or not the Coriolis force. So when you put magnetic field in, you have dynamo action, no problem. So here the thickness is the convection zone, this are field line trace. And when they are red, they point outward and blue inward. And you see you can have trans-equatorial loop if you believe of this potential extrapolation. But this is just. And then you can also wonder, how is the field organized? Because it looks to be quite a mess in the convection zone. And this is the magnetic field in the convection zone itself. And of course, it is messy. It is very related to the turbulence flow you have. But when you add a tachocline, a shear at the bottom of your convection zone, and you organize the magnetic field, you actually can get some kind of nicely organized field with mostly M equal 1 orientation, modulation in phi. So the basic scenario seems to be working. Interface dynamo à la Parker, where you have convection generating field and you pump it down. So clearly the sun is going to react to that magnetism and to this dynamo. You can look at if you put tubes in this simulation and do you understand the emergence, can you get some spot, will they orient well, you know. You can do a lot of things and try to understand the dynamics of structure within the sun to try to make, to be more realistic. When these structures emerge, as we all know, they are unstable, so you expect to have a lot of modulation. These are CMEs. And if you look at the function of the solar cycle and you say, hey, when are these most energetic CMEs and flares, you do find that they are most of the time close to the maximum activity or just after. But there is a lot of activity going on in that. This is the number of sunspots as a function of time. So you have the last three cycles here. No stupid question.
I've never really thought about the sun before, but so the flow of these particles is generating magnetic field, and then the magnetic field is feeding back on the flow?
Full Lorentz force, yes.
So how do you model that?
I didn't show the equation. We do like the climatologists. We have, a Navier-Stokes equation. The big difference is that we assume density contrast. There is a density contrast of 150 in these simulations, or 50. So we don't use shallow water kind of hydrostatic. We are really convective, if this is anelastic approximation. It's Gary and Douglas Goff who have been one of the leaders in that anelastic approximation. So what you do is that you just filter the sound waves, and you have a large density contrast, and you solve Navier-Stokes equation of energy and what we call the induction equation that you can deduce from Maxwell's equation, and you get. So yes, it's a coupled system with two vector fields plus two scalar fields, so kind of interesting. ASH is more like, I would say, a pseudo-DNS, in the sense that what will people do with a large dissimulation, we will say, okay, we put everything in a subgrid scale modeling, and we compute with 128 cube. We don't do that. We compute with 1500 cube, but of course, we cannot, the sun, you will need to perhaps have a million cube or 10 million cube to model it for real, so we cannot afford that. So of course, we put things in a subgrid scale, but we try to go as far as possible to be DNS, and then...
what is your opinion about density concept? How it's important?
I think it's a key. If you could, if I had the money to run a simulation, I mean the time, and we are going to get it, to run a simulation with a density contrast of 1,000, I think it would be even more realistic. And then the idea is to go to higher density contrast.
It's my question. What is your opinion? What we actually will do with magnetic field if contrast increase in your model, for example?
But what we find is that there is a lot of pumping of magnetic field toward the bottom of the convection zone. So larger is your contrast, stronger are your plumes, and more pumping you will get of magnetic field downward. So I will say that magnetic energy will have a tendency to pile down. You know? Yeah, excuse me. So we can. Some people have advocated that, of course, it's important to be able to know the influence of the sun on the Earth, and also for NASA to send people out, in space. So you want to be able to predict that. So some people have been using, you know that in the geophysics community, proxies like the flux, the radio flux at 10.7 centimeters or things like that, try to predict what will be the next cycle. Others have been using models based on mean field dynamo models, and they believe it will be a stronger cycle. So there are debates about is it possible or not to predict the sun and to start to do prediction of the some aspect of the solar activity, of course, on a large average, not on small things, you know. This is interesting, and I think you need to have the kind of approach of what they call ensemble model, Kalman filter, or variational methods of prediction that are used in meteorology, and you need to adapt that to the sun and try to see what you can learn from that. But anyway, there are disagreements on the strength of the cycle, so in 5 year time, when the cycle will have been rising, we will know who was right, and I think it's interesting.
Yes. What do you mean by you know?
But you will have the number. No, but you will have the number of the sunspot, and you will be able to compare to the people who say it will be a weak cycle or the one who says it's a large cycle. Because right now this community is split in two parts. People believe it will be a weak cycle, and others say it will be a strong cycle.
Just to say, last time the prediction which did best was to say last cycle is going to be the same. This cycle is going to be the same as last cycle.
Yeah, and it was completely wrong. Yeah.
Go back. I mean, no, that's because you're bad predictors.
Exactly. Yes.
But always, it's
much bigger. 23 was much bigger than 22.
Range from.
That's already a bad.
Of course. No. I'm just saying that at least if the people who have been pushing for a strong cycle and we got a weak cycle, then they will have to rethink their model. I'm saying is that it's worth trying. You don't know what you will get out of that. You know, it's worth trying. I'm not an advocate. I'm not in that business of doing prediction yet. Perhaps I will come. So, of course, you know the sun, when it becomes active, has a solar wind that is much active. You have current sheet. And the Earth is feeling that. You have a heliosphere. The sun is throwing particles to the Earth in permanence with the solar wind. And when there are CMEs, it's like a storm in this wind, if you want, and a very strong storm. So you have to say it. So we can, for example, with some colleagues in Meudon at the observatory, we are trying to use mean field models to try to predict how the solar wind will vary as a function of solar cycle. So right now, this is very preliminary result. The model is fluctuating. We have two numerical effects. But you can see that the magnetic field configuration is evolving as a function of time, and you can look at the reaction. But we need to do that in a better way through the boundary conditions. So it's not easy. But you can try to see what will be the influence of the solar dynamo and the mean field on the solar wind and its impact on the Earth. Well, that's For example, you know that the magnetic field of the Earth will be subject to that. So I want to speak about the solar irradiance spectra. Of course, the Sun has its maximum luminosity invisible, but we also know that the ultraviolet light will certainly have impact. And so we see a very complex spectra. It's close to a black body at 5,800 K, but there is a lot of variation around that. And you want to know how, with all the flares, all the particles that are thrown at the Earth, what's going to happen. So here I'm coming to the impact of the Sun on the Earth climate. So to answer your question, yes, modulation of total solar irradiance is about 0.1% over the 11-year cycle. So people say, it's very small. You have a lot of input, just a variation of 0.1% is not going to make much. But it seems that from a recent work by Scafetta, and so all the people who are in the climate community, I would like to know what you think of this work of Scafetta. It seems that depending on how you reconstruct the pre-industrial or the Maunder minimum period with the ACRIM total solar irradiance, and making sure that everything fits at current days where we have a satellite observation, and you try to reconstruct back in the past what's going on, it seems that there is disagreement depending on how you do it. And this has serious consequences on what you are obtaining when you try to correlate the modulation of this luminosity of the sun with the mean temperature. Some find that there is good agreement, for example, this is quite good. And others say, for the last 50 years, completely off. So we cannot say there is anything. And of course, there are some people like Lowell who even don't believe on the orchestic aspect of the increase of mean temperature. So what's I'm getting into the climate guys here, asking questions. What is the current understanding of all this? Do we believe the orchestic? Do we believe there is a sharp rise and that we are really warmer? If we believe that, can we really say that we are confident in a way we correlate the variation of the total solar irradiance with the...
Can I just comment on this lean reconstruction? Because
yes.
The way that's achieved is to assume that there are two different classes of stars, and when the sun goes into a minimum, it behaves like a completely different star. And that was based on a kind of bimodal distribution of calcium emission, which has since filled in. So there is no more bimodal distribution, which is why you now get the kind of one type of...
Okay, so no, it's for discussion, you know. I'm not saying, I'm just saying that there are some issues with do they correlate or not. So now, if you look at the work of Kirova et al. In 2003, we know that there is 0.1% variation in the total solar irradiance, but we actually know that it varies much more in the UV. And so what is the impact of the UV? And this work by Kirova demonstrates that even though the variation of the total irradiance in the UV is about 8%, a lot comes from the irradiation. Irradiance change is mostly located in the UV. Up to 60% of this variation of the TSC will be in the UV. And the problem is that we know that the ozone and the Earth absorb a lot of the UV light, and so that can have direct impact on the ozone. So, for example, there is this paper by Palmer where he did a model, one model, and where he didn't have, something specific for the UV light, and one model where he had, he called that ozone control with UV light, and he does get differences up to 20%. So you can wonder, you say, okay, if now, rather than taking just the purely total solar irradiance and saying this is negligible because it's 0.1%, I'm starting to introduce the whole spectra and all the variation and the large variation in the energetic part of the spectra, and I start to consider what are the impact of that in the models. Oh, will we get the same answer? I'm wondering, you know. So it's again a question for you. And then you can also wonder the modulation of magnetic activity over the last century's millennia. And there are some people say that there is a trend, a secular trend, that the sun is more active today than it was before. And independently, even if you take out the modulation of the solar cycle, I'm done. On the last slide is some question.
Yeah,
I want to have a discussion. So you wonder, I mean, it seems that the sun is kind of more active and there are nice correlation with the past, so why suddenly the sun will decorrelate over the last 50 years only due to that? So there's some question. One question which is perhaps hard to answer is, what is the role of the accuracy of the hydro core of your models? I know that the climate people have been putting a lot of effort in the physics, chemistry of their models, but I think that the hydro core is still running at a Lmax of 50, perhaps. We could do perhaps 600 and run this model and see how turbulence and resolution improves. I'm expecting turbulence and the way you treat convection and the atmosphere to have importance. So here, Palmer did some tests and it does find different. So again, what is the role of the UV light in the upper atmosphere in the model, the role of the near-infrared, the variation impact on nitric oxide, I heard about, the role of X-ray. I wanted also to address what is the timing on the Earth's atmosphere to change in luminosity, how it varies with frequency and the circulation process where it triggers. We know, for example, that the ocean takes several years to relax. The response time to the solar variation of 6 to 10 years is plausible. So will some of the change we have undergo at the beginning of the century, will some, in the 20th century, will just show now because the Earth has a kind of inertia. We know that the Sun has a variable magnetic field, so a variable heliosphere, and that there is also a variable geomagnetic field, so a kind of variable shielding of the Earth. So clearly, there is a modulation of the cosmic rays and their impact of low and high altitude clouds. Do we believe its story on the cosmic rays and the clouds? Is it possible? This work by Svensgaard and others? You have to see is the correlation between magnetic activity of the past centuries, millennia, and the mean global temperature something we can believe? Does it make sense to define a mean global temperature? Maybe I'm not even sure that makes sense, but we can that. And that's a question more for the experts. How accurate is the carbon dioxide curve? Is the acoustic phenomena confirmed? We know that they only play for 1% of the greenhouse gases. Water vapor is much more important. How important it is in the model. There were no anthropic carbon dioxide in the medieval maxima in the Little Ice Age, and the sun seems to be the source of this variation. So what's the current understanding of that? And of course, volcanoes, dust. Well, it's a lot of questions, but I mean, to try to get something going. Thank you.
Anybody else
have
any questions?
Or to answer?
It's not a question, in some sense it's comments. We speak in this discussion just about direct input. But we know that sometimes solar rays, alpha particles and another, influence even stronger. Influence of weather. So maybe it's more important in view of instability of climate, not in the development.
Yeah, no, it's why I think there are a lot of questions, and I think you cannot just say the sun doesn't contribute. I mean, if the message is to say to the population in the world, stop polluting, stop driving V8 engine, and go to electric car, that I think we will pretty much all agree with that. The question is, from a scientific basis, is the sun so small in global warming as people want to advocate to push forward the fact that we need to change our way of life? So there are different things. There are the philosophical question, and then there are the science. Do we really understand the climate model well enough to say, yeah, it's sure it's anthropogenic? You know, I'm wondering.
Pretty sure the graph of the sunspots.
So this one?
No.
The one of the yes.
Okay. Yeah. This one.
So. Why is there? You were saying this, I think, that the activity of the sun is much higher now than it was in the past. That's not really true. Site number 19, back before 1960, was the strongest one by far.
Yeah, no, I mean, there is a trend. There is a general trend when you look at this work done by, when you look by the work done by, for example,
1960s.
Now if you look, it goes back to 1600. So this paper by Tapping et al., where Paul Charbonneau is involved, he kind of demonstrates that the total irradiance of the sun as a secular trend.
So I'm
speaking of this secular trend here. Yeah. Okay. So.
1660.
It's
going down.
Going down. Here, a little bit. Okay. Yeah. And let me give you that too. Yeah.
So when put this on, I say good afternoon. And the sun can affect the Earth in major two physical ways, by particles, which you emphasize, and by radiation. We will not be talking about particles. And
your talk is going to be...
Right, okay, I can go. Yeah,
let's just...
Yeah, okay.
How do you
describe it? So we'll be talking only about radiation. When we're talking about radiation, then there is a change in irradiance due to the change in the Earth's orbit, which John...
Okay, so you got some sort of...
Unstable, right?
Unstable. It's this solar pulsing.
Goes... can you get...
Does anybody know how to get it so it's not in slideshow mode? Or whatever Asash has got it in?
Or maybe you reboot?
No, I don't know.
I think you have something automatic going on.
Put in the slideshow.
Yeah, and then I went to full screen. Well,
they automatically scroll.
Full screen.
Something green.
How about the page?
Automatic scroll. What happens if you turn it off and on?
Off, yes.
Yeah, turn it off. Everything turn off.
Okay, and then
right, now.
Yeah,
let's
now put into full screen. Space.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3. So. And I will not talking about this change in solar radiance, which is stays. No, it doesn't go. Can we reboot it? Or you use or put do it, or we can put on your computer, maybe. The change in the radiance could be due to the Earth's orbit. We're closer to the sun or far from the sun, and those are long. Milankovitch cycles, and it's nothing to do with dynamo. So I'll try to be focused on what merged dynamo community and climate community, where the problems are coming. Sasha already alluded to them. Okay, keep it. And then how I can switch from one slide to another? Oh, thank you. So I will be talking only about change in solar irradiance, which is related to dynamo. So which is related to solar activity in simple terms. Remember that in old times people were talking about Can I have a stick? Yeah. About solar constant. So the solar irradiance, it's constant, certain watt per meter square, comes to the Earth's atmosphere. That's all gone. Now we're talking about irradiance. So here's solar irradiance at time 1850 to present. And you can clearly see the solar radiance, which is in watt, 1365 watt per meter square, is changing. Those quasi-periodic variations are 11-year cycle, and as Sasha said, there's also a long-term changes. So that's a time scan of the solar irradiance, which comes to the Earth. If you look at the spectrum wavelengths here, it looks like black body. This is with maximum optical side and this infrared. And UV is actually a small part of the black body. But if you look at derivative of this during time, delta y divided by I, it's dramatically larger than optical and infrared. So this part, UV of the sun, changing substantially. You can argue about all this change, and it gives you only 0.1%, 10 minus 3 effect. What we're talking, folks, about, we can't measure such things with spacecraft. Total radiance variations are small. Nevertheless, there are people, among them K.K. Tung, the editor of Atmospheric Science. He thinks that total radiance is substantially influenced the Earth, and I recommend to read his paper. But today, I will mostly be talking about this UV, which is provenly large, and so on. Next one. So, just to confirm what the problem are, I put a couple of data. Here is total solar irradiance come from a spacecraft called SWORS, and the data is here for about 5 years. They're changing, sometimes deep. Mostly changes are coming because sunspot appears. And they screen, and here's a huge group of sunspot. When it goes up, it's white stuff which starts on the sun appear, what they call pepper and salt. Pepper gives you up, and salt gives you down. So if I decompose into sort of variation of modes, I can see all kind of modes from half of rotation of the sun, 13.27 days, to 11 years and longer. And also long, this is 11-year trend. Next one. If I go to, this is from 2004 to 2007. Next one, you mentioned this Max Planck group, director of Max Planck, himself and his younger collaborators like Natasha Krivova, they studied this data, 1700 to 2004. We're talking about real solar stuff. No C14, usually no proxies. What people do, taking solar data, reconstructed them back, like records of sunspots and faculas and all our kind of physical assumption, and then reconstructed all this mode, that's again the data, reconstructed to 1700 to this, and you see the general trend, function of time, watts per meter square, not much, 1 watt per meter square, but there is a trend, and also interesting modes, like 11-year modes, very substantial, 22 or close, and others, like Glassberg cycle and so on. That's what Dynamo Fox should explain. Because how in the hell are sunspots, which are blocking irradiance or bright spot, which generated magnetic field, produce that type of variations? The next one?
You can click
now. Now click by this?
Yeah.
Oops, by this one?
Yeah.
Okay, so now how we go to the Earth? How we reach the Earth? Here's the Earth, and the size of Chemalungma, and this part of atmosphere, I apologize for climate folks, called troposphere, where we live. Low, it's 10 kilometers. But the upper part, up to 50 kilometers, called stratosphere. And if you look at sun is here, the total irradiance, which is yellow, we can see, comes down to Earth. But UV, thanks God, resides in the stratosphere. Thanks to ozone. When we created ozone hole, it went down. But thanks to absorption by ozone, UV mostly in stratosphere. And of course, visible light reaches the ground and varies weakly, 0.1%. Solar UV varies in stratosphere and varies up to 10%. We're talking a factor of two orders of magnitude. Here, but we don't live in stratosphere. Fortunately or unfortunately, some people like it. Stephen Hawking was launched into stratosphere and enjoy it. So, okay, now I have to hit this one. So, now, first, how from stratosphere we can get to where we live. And second, I would like to distinguish two things. A global, when people say global warming, global temperature change, I'll not be talking about this average over the globe, and I assume this effect is separate and studied through total solar radiance. Well, we're talking about anomalies. So those patchy patterns which you can see on maps instantly, on weather maps where they show, on every climate publications, I would call it patterns, because they actually produce naturally by nonlinear turbulent dynamics, and that's related to the other piece of our conference. So that's why I'm here. So at this point, I would like to give credit to Paul. I know, were you familiar with Sir Gilbert Walker, who was a fellow of Royal Society? At one point, he even was the president of Royal Society. But long ago, in 20th last century, he was sent to India because British had trouble with monsoons. They didn't understand, and Sir Walker went there and solved the problem and discovered so-called so-called Walker circulation. It's along the equator, you see this movement of air, which is related to monsoon problem. At this time, I like this weather line says, his work was not of practical use. And now he is famous. But I don't want to cite Walker circulation. One thing he contributed to the climate science, he was one of the first who attracted attention to climate patterns. If you look at climate patterns. So what do I mean? Here, example of climate patterns. One of climate patterns familiar is, especially in this state, El Niño and La Niña. It's ocean pattern. Here's the Pacific Ocean. You have this tongue of cold air from Japan to California. And it's a big pattern. Another pattern, which in the stratosphere called QBO, quasi-biennial oscillation, repeated pattern in time. Another pattern which John discussed, I will discuss today, called in Atlantic Ocean, North Atlantic Oscillation or North Annual Mode, which talk about. This is the contrast of temperature. And there's in Pacific. Patterns I put on page. You look, they are of hemispheric size. They're big. And Sir Walker was the first who attracted attention. How in the hell there is correlation from this point?
This is 500 hectopascal heights.
Yeah.
I don't think it's temperature.
It's probably geopotential height. I can see it. Here's the temperature. Here's the temperature, SST. And here's the 500. Yeah. How a point here knows about point here? What they call teleconnection, they introduce work. This sort of long-range correlation. And moreover, you can produce this randomly, and then they're gone. The issue is those patterns are stable. They sort of change in time, vary in sign, but are very stable. So this this is very interesting thing. This highly dynamical, turbulent Earth system produce this stable, what in turbulence call it, coherent structures. That's what we have. And I'll focus on this mode, which John mentioned in her talk, a very clear case called North Annual Mode or Southern Annual Mode. Annual. Here's a patch of pressure or geopotential heights, which is higher and lower. Or winds, stronger here, weaker here. Or stronger here in blue and weaker here. This is one mode of NAM, low pressure, strong wind, and here. It's up to 20 degrees, from 20 degrees north to 90 degrees. It's a huge hemisphere. And it's annular, like a cylinder. And the same in the south. One interesting thing, and I'll mention again, the sun affected this pattern during Maunder minimum. But the other thing I also mentioned here, this SAM was affected by human being by keeping this chlorocarbon from old refrigerators and so on, creating ozone hole, allowing UV going down for several tens of years, and that's why we don't have melting ice in Antarctica and ice melts here. The different way, he was solar influence, he is a human influence, but controlling the window for solar UV. If you think about it, the same effect, we'll be talking about control UV by the solar, by the sun itself, dynamo, and control UV entrance by human being by injecting these chemicals into, thanks to the Canadian protocol, we close the hole and now melt Antarctica. So, why those modes are real? I just give an example, which is Thompson and others. At positive NAM, all this winter in Alaska, Chicago, Paris, Moscow, Tokyo, it is 100 degrees. In a negative NAM mode, dramatic, statistically significant change. This mode is real and did affect. And John showed that Vikings and Europe in medieval time were affected by it. So one important thing, this mode, this is a height now, sea level stratosphere. It's like a cylinder goes up. This is a projection on the ground, again, cold, warm, and it goes up. And as shown by Baldwin and Dunkerton, this again height and latitude, poles, north, south. Mode, if it appears in stratosphere, goes down within a couple of weeks. It's a one stage and another stage. What's important, and Jones showed that if we study this mode for high solar activity red and low solar activity, you will see in the stratosphere and the troposphere, in the beginning of winter, the time of winter, beginning of winter, we have this effect across stratosphere, or in the late winter, across the stratosphere. She already mentioned it. And also, if you go to the time of Maunder minimum, 1700, because of 70 years, the sun was forcing this mode, the Earth had this predominant temperature pattern, which corresponds to NAM mode, cool Europe, northern Europe, warm Greenland. So one important thing you have to carry out of this, it requires not the magnitude of effect, but the duration of the effect. Just because it was 70 years, it's a low frequency mode, the Earth responded. If I change now, the same amount of UV, solar UV, I will not produce this pattern, or it will disappear. So important is duration. There's some possible understanding how the system works. If I plot this position of NAM, positive and negative, it's like particle, people say, is potential with two states. So normally, Earth push this mode from one state to another by own instability. You have to correct in the beginning, I was disturbed by You move a system from one well to another. What the sun does, if for a long time it prefers one well, like during Maunder minimum, it lowers the well. And all this we call in solid states, we call Cramer's chemical game. You go from one well to another well, but if this well is deeper, you can stuck here. That's what, at least, our hypothesis is what happened during Maunder minimum. And to come to conclusions at this point, certainly we believe, and we have some sort of observational support of this, and some modelers like Goddard Institute, they run models supporting this as well. The soil variability affects those coherent structure patterns. In particular, proof of annual mode is there. And what's interesting, patterns themselves stay, but the frequency of their occurrence. Suppose you can stuck in negative state of this mode, in one of the states. That's where you need a duration of the solar activity. And dynamo should explain the origin of Maunder minimum, why the sun were not active for a long time, why it changed. It's still stuck in explanation of 11-year cycle. Folks, you need to go to a longer period. Thank you. Yeah, I can.
What kind of moon that you absorb in this pattern? Is it Rossby wedge?
That's a good question. My belief is, and the origin of this, there's two groups. One group from Princeton believe that those annular modes are excited by pure noisy atmosphere. I think that excitation is related more to we launch planetary waves, Rossby waves. And the Rossby waves, very fast, during a few days, they propagate to stratosphere straight. And in stratosphere, you have the floor, like rotation in the solar, but it's, we call it zonal floor. And the interaction of zonal floor and planetary waves produce a system with two states and explain this mode. This is good because in a stratosphere, we don't have what pure turbulent convective troposphere. So I believe it's nonlinear interaction of planetary waves with a zonal floor. There is some publication, but it's still open question.
What are the main competing models for the Little Ice Age?
Yeah, it's a good question. Main competing mode, of course, the radical point of view has nothing to do with the sun. It's just coincidence, because if you take Little Ice Age, it's longer than Maunder minimum, longer than 70 years. Fortunately, the Maunder minimum comes to the deepest part of it. So, there's no explanation from these people. The other real competing hypothesis is volcanoes. Recently, this year, we were at source meeting, it was a talk that at that time, again, the time of reign of Louis XIV, when Maunder minimum happened, sun was very clear. He was king of sun, we call king of Soleil. At the same time, it was excessive amount of volcanoes. And aerosols put this mode, apparently, or temperature into this mode. So that's what I know. Maybe, John, you had two or three you mentioned.
Different time. It was preceding time during the mm-hmm. So it really doesn't refer to the moon.
I mean the volcanoes?
Yes.
No, I heard him about the same time. Okay. I have a paper unpublished, a talk about volcano hypothesis, which is strictly competing with the sun.
Back to the planetary zonal flow interaction story, Sasha.
Yeah.
Do the two states correspond to what might be called a wave-dominated state and a zonal flow-dominated state? What's the nature of the bifurcation and what's the control parameter?
The nature of bifurcation, both zonal wind and planetary wave involve. First folks thought, okay, I will run waves across a given wind, and that explains something. The other folks did
share energy.
They change wind by waves,
right,
damping energy. What happened? If you write equations, a coupling term is so strong. Both variables involved, and I run simple equations. And somebody here gave a talk about this as well. You need to involve both on equal right because interaction is so strong. Coupling is one.
I understand.
Not epsilon.
I understand that. What I'm wondering though is even if you have two equal players, the two states can have different ratios of the two players, and I was wondering, that's a very familiar kind of bifurcation in these...
Not without external forcing, like the sun or volcano.
That must enter the control parameter, but I suppose what I'm asking is there must be other things like damping or
Yeah, of course you have damping, you have input parameter, intensity of waves are coming, and damping coefficient, and what, strangely enough, very critical parameter is a gradient of acclimatological temperature. Your undisturbed gradient. Okay, we can talk. I don't want to eat time from Peter. I'm here, open to other questions. Peter, all yours.
Thanks.
Hope you will not have trouble.
Other troubles, probably. So, let's put it in here. This one goes with that one there, I guess. So, I will get rid of this one here. Let's see now. Oh, okay, it's looking cool. Okay. Good. So, what I will talk about is some statistical analysis on, I mean, starting from the other end, we have a data series and we want to attribute causes to the variations in that data series. And the reason why this is interesting is that the variations seen here, which I will explain in a while, has been sort of proposed being attributed to a periodicity in the solar variations. So this is another larger timescale because these are data from the Ice Age going back here 80,000 years. So I did give one talk. These are paleoclimatic data from ice cores. And what you see here, just to set your mind right, the time goes in this direction. So this is the present. And actually, it doesn't really go back to the present. This is minus 15. 1,000 years. I'll show you another one just a little later. But the things that I'll discuss are these abrupt climate changes here, which are numbered, and these are called the Danske Earthquake events. And what's very important from a climatic point of view is, of course, how can we attribute a cause to them? And this is here from the American core. There are two cores. There's an American and a European core that were drilled at the same time, and they correlate well. They're dated in a little bit different way, which means that there's, of course, an uncertainty in the dating here. which means, which of course influences the correlation with other events. So that's an important thing. But the whole business started by looking at the spectral content. I don't know why it's so weak in this data series. So this is the power spectrum, and what you see here is a pronounced peak around 1500 years, more accurately 1470 years. So this was sort of adopted into the climate community, that there was a period, a periodic occurrence of these events with a period around this time, 1470 years. And it's actually, I mean, it sticks out. This is a logarithmic scale, so there is weight in that. Actually, in the dating on the European core, the peak did not show up as pronouncedly as in this one here. So the problem is, of course, how significant is this? Is this just occurring by chance, or is this really a phenomenon that that governs the dynamics of this ice core? Of course, what most people would do is they say, you know, this has a significance above 95% level, you know. But then, of course, you have to ask, in comparison to what? Because people would usually use a power spectrum that would be a normal red noise spectrum, and then you'd see what is the chance it comes above there. That is the same as assuming that this series here is really produced, that this series here is really produced by an Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process or a noise process like that. Everybody can just look at that and see, and that is not the thing you could compare against. Therefore, you have to come up with a different model that you would compare against in order to see if this is really significant or not. And what you also see, which is very important, is that this is very far from being sort of a sinusoidal change with that period here. So a power spectrum is, first of all, not the very best way of looking at it. So what is a much better way is, of course, count your way down and see if there's a period there. So this is what I will concentrate on, if there's a period. And we know there are periods, of course. Periods, as physicists, we like periods. We like, you know, harmonic oscillators, and we know there are periods here. These are really nice periods. And we have periods in the orbit of the Earth around the Sun, and perhaps there are solar cycles. That's what's been proposed for this one, to explain this one here. Actually, it's been proposed to be a beating of two solar cycles here. Okay, so now, how do we go about this is technical details. How we define it, we don't care about that now. How do we detect a period in a series like that? So now imagine what we do is we have simply defined where these occur in the series in a specific way, and so we have a series of times. And this series of times we want to find out, are these periodically occurring? Okay. Well, obviously, they're not periodic as I drew them here. We would sort of miss a point in here, or maybe miss 2 points, and what do you? So if they're periodic, what we do is, of course, we take this time series and we wrap it around a cylinder like that. And if it's periodic, the crosses, they should line up here. And the period is, of course, 2 pi times the radius of this cylinder here. Now we're looking for a period. We don't know the period of that. So we have two things we have to do. We have to wrap it around that, choose a radius, and then see if they line up. And then afterwards we'll change the radius for doing that. That's sort of a standard technique thought about already by Rayleigh. So the way to see if these points they line up, we could just write, choose this period tau here, write all the points as a cosine and sine, and then we just add up the sum of numerical value of this one here, which of course if they're evenly distributed on the circle here, they'll tend to be zero, and if they all fall in the same place, this will tend to be the number of points, so 1 divided by n. So r, the Rayleigh r, is a number between 0 and 1. So let's do that exercise for this data set here.
Assuming that amplitude of your oscillator is constant.
No. I do nothing with the oscillator. I just pick out, here's an event, here's an event, here's an event. So I have a series of times. I forget about sort of the actual shape. What I do know is that I can very well define the initiations of these climate changes. And I just count when are they occurring. Okay?
When you say it is event or not event?
Yes. Yes, yes. And that's an easy thing to do in this one here. As I show in a little while, there are a little bit of disagreements on that. But anyway. Okay, so what do? I change my radius. I calculate this number here. And as a function of my radius or the period here, I get a value of this that runs like that. And here you see it sticks out to the value. This is 0.8 on the scale from 0 to 1. Looks pretty good, and this is the 1500 years period. If I pull that out, make this one here, and wrap my data series, this is how the points they cluster. So you see there is a clustering here, and I will have, you know, all the time I'll have red and blue numbers, and that's simply the American dating and the European dating. So this is sort of a measure of the uncertainty in the dating, because of course it is the same date, we just don't know. Okay, that's one way of measuring it. Another way, we just flash that very quickly, because this was sort of the
standard deviations above just a random occurrence.
That is good question. I like that question. Perfect question. So here you choose a period here, and so this is sort of the waiting time between two events, and if it's periodic it would fall on these lines here, and you can just sort of see the deviation from that is really the distance between these lines and points. So this is just another way of calculating the same. I did this because this was in the literature, but I But let's just stay with the other measure here. Okay, so this is now the same data as I showed you now. It's just sort of higher quality, and it starts all the way up. Here is the interglacial time, and this is Younger Dryas, Brillinghead, and back in the Ice Ages. And now we put in the sticks here, and you really see for these two series that it looks like it's really significantly hitting sort of the right spots here. It's a little bit off there and there and there. It's fine. It misses one, but there's another one coming here. And this one is maybe not so good. It's in between two and this one, and it actually continues down there. Looks nice. However, if you look at if you compare here with the American one here. Well, actually, they line up pretty well here, but if you go, well, further down here, they actually shift one in comparison to each other. So this is sort of the uncertainty. So now, returning to the question, you know, how significant is this? Is this really, I mean, it's very convincing as you look at it. However, how do we test this? And the problem is, of course, always that our eyes are for patterns. I mean, we love patterns. And we make theories based on patterns and our pattern recognition and so on. And, you know, and it can be very hard, you know, to know what are we really looking for here. You know, who, what's the chance that, you know, a face would turn up on the surface of Mars just by chance? And it's a little bit the same as far as, you know, you walk on a sidewalk and then you see the all the gum marks and then just you see the Big Dipper there, you know. Wow, that's the Big Dipper. You know, what's the chance that people that spit in one place there just made the Big Dipper? But you have a lot of patterns in there, and you choose the pattern based on what you saw, which means that you have a very hard time in really doing that. So that is what we have to do now. We have to choose a model of how is this made, and then, of course, compare with that here. So, sort of from an Occam's razor point of view, the simplest thing is, of course, that this is just a random occurrence. They just happen to be there with a certain time scale that's given by a Poisson distribution, which means that really the waiting times are not periodically occurring, but they're occurring with an exponential distribution like that. Okay.
So that's easy,
because what you do then, well, first of all, this is how it looks if you with that I sat here, and the straight line is the exponential distribution. So it seems like a reasonable model to infer. And so what do you do? Well, you just go to the computer and simulate series of that length in order to see if a pattern would turn up just coincidentally to have the same type of periodicity here. So we can just use the mean waiting time from the observed data, which is 2,800 years, and then simulate this. And for each simulation, the length of the record, we get a distribution. Let's just concentrate on this side. These are just the two different measures, so never mind this one. It gives the same results here. So I run my Poisson process 1,000 times, and I get a distribution of this one measure, which is the sort of amount of periodicity in there. So for each of these artificially made series, I run it through the measure of this one here, and I get this distribution here. Okay, and what you see here are the data. Easy thing would of course be if there was one data point, but there are unfortunately discussions on, you know, what's best, the American or the European. And there's one guy, Stefan Rahmstorff, who thinks that, oh, there's one event, which was the one that landed exactly in between events here, should not be counted. So he gets the significance which is out here, but the bulk of the distribution is really inside here, which means that you could by chance get this periodicity just from a random series.
What does it mean, this blue-dish line?
This is the 95% confidence. This is the 99% confidence. So he's actually out here at the 99% confidence level. So when I did this, he was very happy about that, but I mean, I think we should look at these things in here. Okay, so this should sort of be end of story. However, of course it's not, because we cannot really prove anything this way. So let's just repeat what we are at. Logically, we have to come up with a null hypothesis. And our null hypothesis is that this object is a crocodile, which of course is not such a bad choice. Sort of got the same color. And what you would look for would be the sort of a characteristic that's really something there. And we're physicists, and we're very much into scaling. And this is a very nice example of scaling, you know. That's sort of a crocodility, which is that the ratio of the length to the width. It's a very constant thing, which is, of course, what you would then be observing. You know, they're hatched like that, and they just look like that, and, you know, at some point they're very long, and they look like that still. So that's, of course, your first choice of measure, which is the ratio of the length to the width. So go out, or preferentially you send some students out to measure all these crocodiles, and you get a measure here with some distribution, and your object here is right in the middle. Right? So that's sort of where we are on that. And of course, everybody knows the result. You cannot really confirm, you can only reject another hypothesis. So of course we have to look for another quantity that would distinguish our object from this one here. So we send the students out again to count the number of legs.
The number of your students declining.
that's how it goes. Okay, so let's then see if there are some different models that we can reject. For instance, I'll speed up here. I'm not sure, and I'll just speed up. So, well, shouldn't accept that as a German. Okay, now this is a periodic thing here, which occurs with the period. Sometimes it doesn't kick in, but it does the other time. So the model is that it's an integer times this time scale plus some noise that would sort of put it around here. Okay, and we put the noise at 100 years, sort of estimated from the uncertainty in the timing and so on. This can of course be discussed and so on. But this model here, which is sort of a very simple model, I can do the same game again, you know, do 1,000 simulations, and I get a distribution like that. I mean, this model would really kick out as being periodic. So this model can be rejected for these ones here at the 99% confidence level. So this is not what's happening here. And what's been discussed, I'm almost done here, is that this is really a stochastic resonance, which is, did I put it up here? Here, a stochastic resonance, which you probably all know, this fact that you have, maybe I can just go ahead one more just to explain it. That you would have a situation where you have a potential that would be changing periodically, and you go through a hysteresis loop like that. Okay. However, if you don't reach exactly to the bifurcation point, you won't have a hysteresis unless you have a little bit of noise that would take you across the barrier here. So what you need in that case, back here, what you need in that case is a relationship between the three times you have in your system. You have one time, which is, you know, what is the period of the oscillation of your potential. The other times are the two escape times, or Arrhenius times, going from the deep well to the shallow well, and the other one go from the shallow well to the deep well. Now, if this stochastic system should be periodic, what it really has to do is, in this situation, the time scale going from here to there should be short in comparison to the time scale going from here to there, right? And the time scale of jumping back again before I'm in this situation here should be long. So I have to squeeze a time in between, and that's really the resonance of this system here. So if you do that, what happens here? If you do that, of course, you can have a resonance, a periodic component, you know, as small as you want. So it's sort of, you imagine that you have two wells here. I mean, you could have something that went just tiny change here, right? With a high, you can't see. You can imagine.
Right?
Oh. There you go. Okay. Or you could have something that does like that to the other situation, to that situation here, right? You're almost at the bifurcation point. Or you could have something that does this. And obviously, no matter how you tune your noise in this situation, it's further from the resonance than here. And actually, you could go continuously from a situation where it's just a post-sound process, which it would be if these stay still, to the situation where it's perfectly periodic, right? And this is what you see here. This is what you see here, going from a situation where you're almost at the bifurcation point here to a situation where you end up in the Poisson process again. And this is really the parameter you change here. It's really the squeezing of these times around that one here. I'm done. A coffee is waiting. And if you do the same exercise with the stochastic resonance, what you see here is that you can exclude stochastic resonance of a certain strength. But of course, since it continuously goes into the Poisson process, you cannot exclude it below a certain level. But what's interesting here is that this random one I have here actually describes the data better than a very low stochastic resonance here. How can that be? Well, it's simply because I choose the stochastic resonance frequency here, right? So I'm looking for that frequency. And what happens for this low value here is that it will by chance pick up another frequency that's there, just by chance, which is then more probable. Which means, of course, there's no way we can talk about such a weak stochastic resonance being supported by the data. Unless, of course, we have a theory and this and that. I think I should end with this. Good.
Steal our coffee and then
we're all here.
We'll be minus 5 minutes to get us to the top.
I only have 2 points to make.
Me for some time, and that is why people expect a nonlinear dynamical system with lots of feedbacks to respond to this neighborhood feedback. Don't really get that. And then, so you show this what looks periodic, but you're taking one variable out of like a good. How do you represent a system? I mean, were it the sun, at least you could say, well, it's not uniform, but it's kind of, you know, random from one place to another. And so how do you know
that? I mean, that would be great if we had like a spatial count. The thing is, in these time scales, we only have, you know, 3 points around the globe. And unfortunately, on sort of these large fluctuations like ice ages and so on, they all, you know, work in different.
Not according to Jones' talk.
He's European, but he used American data, GISP, back to politics.
Wow.
Yeah,
okay, well, I'll be very quick because coffee's waiting. So we've heard a lot about solar activity and whether it can be important for climate. And of course, if you were interested in solar activity in the past of climate, you might want to have a proxy for solar activity. And the one that people talk about, and Joan talked about this last week, on the whole is beryllium 10, which is a good proxy for solar activity, because cosmic rays coming into the Earth's atmosphere is deflected by the solar magnetic field. And what I'd like to say today is that there is a better proxy, which is extracted from the beryllium 10 concentration, which is actually the modulation potential of the sun's magnetic field, which takes out, if you like, terrestrial effects. So don't ask me how these guys do it, but they go in and they measure the beryllium 10 concentration, and you can see that this is anti-correlated with, say, sunspot numbers. And of course, from that you have to construct, you have to have some hypothesis for constructing beryllium 10 production, and then from that you have to have some hypothesis for reconstructing the modulation potential, which is a good measure of what the sun's magnetic field and probably total solar irradiance and the other ultraviolet things that we've heard about today. Beryllium 10 can give you a certain amount of information. It can tell you that there was, you know, there are these minima events that they recur. It can also tell you that there is a cycle, a dynamo cycle or an 11-year cycle, which goes through the Maunder minimum, so that although the sunspots switched off, it seems that there was a dynamo cycle still going. So if you're interested in, say, resonant forcing of the climate, then there might be still some resonance that's going on at this time, even though sunspot numbers have switched off. And beryllium 10 data, you can extract, you can go back to probably 40,000 years. I think they've probably done it for now. And of course, you can do periodograms and pull out frequencies. As Peter was saying, you can always pull out frequencies, but whether these are statistically significant, I think this one actually is another question. But all I'd like to say today is that it's worth trying to work with the modulation potential. So here's a different proxy, which is taken from the beryllium 10 or the carbon 14. So both of these information is fed in.
Beryllium 10 from an ice core.
Yeah, beryllium 10 from an ice core. That's right. Yeah, or carbon 14 from tree rings, for example. Yeah. And you can get, and so the long-term trend, which is often seen in beryllium data, which is due to variations in the geomagnetic field, is automatically subtracted out of this. And you can get a nice data set which goes back, say, 10,000 years, and you can look at solar variability on this time scale. And this modulation potential, so if you're interested in doing this, you could look at this paper, or this paper, which I'll try and put on the wiki. This modulation potential has a nice normal distribution, and you can see there are times when activity is high and times when activity is low. And if you just look at the beryllium 10 data, you might conclude, and there's a recent Nature paper by Solanki et al, that solar magnetic activity is essentially as high as it's ever been in the last 2,000 years. However, if you look at the modulation potential, you know, here we are currently, but you can see there are a few events where we have been at or even higher than the current activity. One thing Sasha was talking about is we'd like to predict what's going to happen next. So you can say, although we're in a kind of maximum at the moment where, you know, we're very high, you can try and plot a distribution of how long these maxima tend to last, these kind of solar maxima. And this is a distribution here, which is not badly fitted by a gamma distribution. But if you have a look at how long the longest of these maxima events has occurred, then the longest maximum we've had is something like 90 years, and we've been in the current maximum for about 80 years. So one might expect, naively, that we're going to drop off. So solar magnetic activity might drop off in the near future, which is kind of interesting, because as Sasha said, that would, all other things being equal, have a cooling effect. Although whether that's enough to offset anything is an interesting question. And the second, so that's the first point. The second point I'm trying to make before coffee is, if one is really interested in putting solar variability into climate models, then I think it's important to keep both the frequency and duration information, as Sasha said. I did a very simple model of this. So we took the simplest solar dynamo model you can take. It's a third-order nonlinear differential equation, which contains both the cycle and the modulation of the basic cycle, and we fed it into a two-state oscillator of the type described by Sasha, we took a simple Lorentz equations, so there's a type of flipping between, a natural flipping between two states, the sort you see here, and we feed a very small amount of this into this, and say, what does the frequency of the basic cycle and the modulational cycle have on the dynamics, even for a very weak forcing? This may tell you something a bit more about coupled chaotic oscillators, although these two chaotic oscillators are very different from each other, and there's only a one-way coupling. So this is the Sun and this is the Earth, in case you're getting a bit confused. And you can see, well, there's very different behaviours, as you might expect from a nonlinear dynamical system. And of course it depends on the frequency of the forcing and the frequency of the modulation, so this how often it goes into a minimum, and perhaps you can see it better here, or maybe you can't. This is the forcing, so we have an 11-year cycle which is actually too fast to see, and this is the modulation, so this is the chaotic oscillator going into minima, and this is the effect it has on the climate for a certain frequency of modulation or a certain frequency of basic forcing. And then we change the frequencies and we get very different distributions for the distributions of flipping times. And if you're at a resonance or near resonance, it's hard to talk about resonances when both of your oscillators are chaotic, but if you're at some sort of near resonance, then you can get these long tails of the distributions of going from one of these states to another, and it can have a very profound effect. So this is a very simple model of the Sun acting on climate over long timescales, and I think it's important to keep, although the amplitude, as Sasha said, of basic driving, if you like, changes in total solar irradiance are very small, I think it's important to keep the frequencies in, because as we saw from Sasha Rizmaikin's talk, there are basic frequencies, there are decadal frequency variations in the nonlinear Earth system, and they may respond in an interesting manner to the 11-year, the 70-year cycles that you see in the solar data. So that wasn't quite minus 5 minutes, but it was pretty close. Okay, thank you. Oh, Peter.
I mean, can you analyze the red fog in order to say what is happening? It's going in and out of what?
Yeah.
Skewing the attractor? Or?
That's right, you skew the attractor. So yeah, I can talk to you about that.
The
paper's on the wiki, but I can give you the paper. Yeah. I agree. Yeah. For the